Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, July 5th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. We'll begin with the mini editorial, which was written by Roger L. Wilson of Mobile. And Roger writes, "A few months ago, Senate Majority Leader Schumer told a pro-abortion rally in front of the Supreme Court building that, 'I want to tell you, Gorsuch, I want to tell you, Kavanaugh, you have released the whirlwind and you will pay the price. You won't know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions overturning Roe.' Demonstrations outside several judges' homes in violation of federal law were allowed to continue. These threats and intimidation of certain Supreme Court judges should not be tolerated." Again, this was written by Roger L. Wilson of Mobile. Our first front page article is written by Earl Horlick of the Sioux City Journal, and the headline is, "Sioux City East High School Student Reflects on Being Elected Governor of Iowa's Boys State." It may have been Destiny Adams' destiny to be elected governor during the American Legion of Iowa's Boys States competition. Or, at the very least, the East High School's first name made for a very catchy campaign slogan. All of my campaign material played off of "This is my destination" or "This is our destination," Adams said. "I think my name, Destiny, was memorable enough to get me noticed." Which wasn't a bad thing at Iowa Boys State, which was held June 19 through 24 at Johnston, Iowa's Camp Dodge. Sponsored by the American Legion, Iowa Boys State is a week-long, hands-on youth civics leadership experience in the operation of the democratic form of government. Participating students were chosen based on referrals of local American Legion posts, as well as their civics teachers. Adams, along with classmates Jackson Johnson and Nate Ruiz, represented East. "I had to campaign to become governor, writing papers, giving speeches, and persuading others to vote for me," Adams said. That was a new experience for Adams, who was born and lived with his parents, Davidson and Ruth Adams, in the West African country of Nigeria until the family moved to the United States when he was 11 years old. "I think I appreciate American history more because it is new to me," he said. "Everyone can have a voice in a democratic government." During the bus ride to Camp Dodge, Adams befriended Evan Jansen, a Rock Valley, Iowa student and a fellow Boy Stater. "Evan ran as governor, lieutenant governor, on the same ticket as me," he said. "So that means both the governor and the lieutenant governor of Boys State came from Northwest Iowa." Ironically enough, Jansen's family is moving to Sergeant Bluff, and next year he will be a student at Sergeant Bluff Luton High School. "I plan on staying in touch with Evan," Adams said. A wide receiver on East Black Raiders football team, Adams said he was considering studying architecture or engineering in college. He's even considering a career as an artist or becoming an entrepreneur. While Adams wasn't selected to be a delegate at the American Legion's Boys Nation, taking place in Arlington, Virginia on July 22nd, he will be one of the alternates. However, he now has the confidence to speak in public and have his voice heard. Would Adams ever consider a career in politics? He said, "If it is my destiny, I will." Our next headline is, Iowa's chief economist talks healthy state revenue numbers. State tax revenue in Iowa continued on a strong path in May, when net tax revenue was up nearly $402 million, a 42% increase over May of 2021. State sales, income, fuel, and gambling taxes all increased, according to the state's nonpartisan fiscal service agency. The Journal Des Moines Bureau talked with Robin Anderson, the state's chief economist in the Iowa Department of Management, about what's causing such healthy state finances and how long it may last. Anderson's answers are edited only for brevity and clarity. Question: what has led to sales tax receipts being so healthy, including over last year? Answer: I think it goes to the health of the economy and consumer spending. The other caveat I would say is certainly we have seen some inflation, and sales tax revenue is nominal. So some of the inflationary pressures might be putting some upward drift on sales tax data. I do want to emphasize, though, even before the really high inflation numbers you've seen over the last few months, sales tax revenue has been very strong. I think that just shows really distinctive consumer spending is in the state, and this aligns with the national level data that we see. Question: state income taxes are up, even though fewer Iowans are working since before the pandemic. How does that happen? Answer: I think there's a couple of things going on. Wage growth has been very strong. I think that's showing up in the withholding data. And wage growth has been, even though jobs are not where they were prior to the pandemic, wage growth is exceeding what it was prior to the pandemic. In addition, we have healthy income pay returns, which include other income sources, including capital gains and farm income and business income. And those other income sources were very strong in tax year 21. Question. Will we start to see a decline in state income tax receipts with the new tax law, which will gradually reduce state income tax rates going into effect? If so, when? Answer. Certainly, as tax rates go down, we're going to be seeing less income tax coming in. And I think the other thing that's going to be affecting this is just the trajectory of the economy and how wage growth, how capital gains income, and how business income is doing. That's also going to matter for receipts going forward. Question. What do the coming months look like for total state tax revenues? Will the good news continue? Answer. I think right now state revenues are very healthy. Certainly the budget situation, at least for this year, is very strong. Stepping away from that, which is all good news, I think there's a lot of uncertainty about where the U.S. economy is headed right now. And there's a lot of debate about recession risk right now. And that's something we are watching. Again, this was a question and answer with the Journal Des Moines Bureau and Robin Anderson, who works in the Iowa Department of Management. Nebraska medical marijuana campaign says it might fall short. A campaign to legalize marijuana for medicinal use in Nebraska is in danger of missing its signature goal to qualify for the November general election ballot, organizers said. Nebraskans for Medical Marijuana still needs to gather thousands of signatures ahead of Thursday's submission deadline set by the state, campaign leaders said. The campaign suffered a major blow when one of its top donors died, forcing organizers to rely primarily on volunteers. The campaign needs valid signatures from 7% of Nebraska's registered voters, roughly 87,000 voters, to appear on the ballot. Voters would decide in November whether to legalize the drug for medical uses. Some prominent elected officials, including Governor Pete Ricketts, remain firmly opposed to legalization and have actively fought the measure. We now have a review of Saturday in the Park, written by Bruce Miller from the Journal. And the headline is, Avid Brothers, Buddy Guy, and L. King make it a Saturday to remember. And L. King, her name is spelled E-L-L-E, and I'm not sure if you pronounce it L or L-E, so I'm just going to stay with L. L. King drew the biggest crowd, Buddy Guy earned the most applause, and the Avid Brothers got the biggest buy-in. At this year's Saturday in the Park, there was something for everyone and a sense of relief that the annual concert in Grandview Park was somewhat back to normal. King felt so at home, she brought her baby out to meet concertgoers. Guy went one better and waded into the audience and serenaded a fan on the benches. At the night's closer, the Avid Brothers had the biggest show. It boasted plenty of lighting tricks and a band that was really second to none. Sorry, buddy, these guys really rocked. Opening with Don't Be Scared, the Avids never really let one song rest until another one started. With more strings than a banjo, they were able to conjure a multitude of sounds. Satan pulls the strings, let them introduce the band's eclectic nature, and hear Seth Avid take the lead before handing it over to Brother Scott. The lyrics on most of their songs are like limited television series. They tell distinct stories and offer enough food for thought you need more than one listen to grasp all that they're saying. On their album, Closer Than Together, they have so many fitting words they could easily be chronicling life post-pandemic. Instead, it was released before all the chaos started to unfold, and it's more important than ever. Down With the Shine expands the thought, even though it was released in 2012. A phenomenal light show accompanied the songs, suggesting someone could easily turn the Avid's output into something like Bob Dylan's Girl from the North Country. While Buddy Guy gave new meaning to the term blue, he swore more than I do, he was right in his element, starting with Damn Right I've Got the Blues, and rolling through the hits to Downhearted and Boom Boom. Wearing a polka dot shirt to match his polka dot guitar, he frequently chided the audience for not getting its part of the songs right. I can't do it by myself, he offered, then proved he really could. Going into the audience, which must have been a security nightmare considering the Grammy winner is 85, he created what most have what must have been the most photographed moment of the day, serenaded Janie Vigueras, who was visiting from Mexico. Guy was like a 21-year-old teen idol, lapping up the attention. His band, while a bit too loud for the outdoor setting, matched him note for note and offered enough extended play moments that Guy could have taken a break and still jumped in. Guy, though, wasn't having any of that. He got some of his best reaction from Skin Deep and admitted he could have played longer than he was contracted. Coming immediately after King, Guy must have known the bar was raised, mixing all sorts of genres into one. She's like a one-woman Saturday in the Park. King embraced the audience and did everything but tap dance as she sang plenty of those wailingly good songs. Elle brought her baby on stage and everything went downhill from there, she predicted fans would say. Instead, Baby Lucky just made concertgoers love her more. Similar to her Drunk and I Don't Want to Go Home partner Miranda Lambert, King won a lot of fans with America's Sweetheart, a song everyone could warm to, and surprisingly, one that fit neatly with the Abbott's messaging. A fun day at the park, Saturday's event made us feel, even for a few hours, that the outside world didn't feel like it was encroaching on our little place on earth. As King said, I could get used to this town. It's a beautiful, beautiful city. And Saturday, it certainly was. Well, now to go to the weather forecast. And today, on Tuesday, it's going to be hot and humid again with a possible strong afternoon thunderstorm. And with a predicted high of 97 and a low tonight of 72. And there's, again, for overnight, they're predicting thunderstorms. Wednesday will be very warm with possible thunderstorms with a high of 90 and a low of 70. Thursday will be very warm with thunderstorms in spots with a high of 89 and a low of 71. Friday will be humid and maybe a thunderstorm in the morning, high of 88 and a low of 69. And Saturday is going to be mostly sunny and very warm with a high of 93 and a low of 68. We'll now move to the business section, and our first story is a punishing 6 months for investors. Stock market sees worst start to year in more than five decades. Americans with stock portfolios or retirement investment plans would likely prefer to forget the past 6 months. The S&P 500, Wall Street's broad benchmark for many stock funds, closed the first half of 2022 with a loss of more than 20% after starting the year at an all-time high. It's the worst start to a year since 1970, when Apple and Microsoft had yet to be founded. Investors have been grappling with uncertainty and fear this year, following a sharp rise in interest rates as the Federal Reserve and other central banks scramble to tame the highest inflation in more than 40 years. Higher rates can bring down inflation, but they also slow the economy, raising the risk of a recession. That's helped drag down the values of stocks and bonds, cryptocurrencies, and other investments. On June 13th, the S&P 500 tumbled into a bear market, dropping more than 20% below the record high it set in early this year. It's now 20.4% below the January 3rd all-time high, back to where it was in late 2020. The Fed has been at the center of the market's downturn, raising its key short-term interest rates three times this year. Its most recent increase earlier this month was triple the usual amount and its biggest hike since 1994. More outside increases are almost certain. You could argue that they're just playing the hand they were dealt, but the reality is they got caught a little bit behind the curve and their pivot toward a much more aggressive policy stance has been the reason the market has sold off, said Russ Mayfield, investment strategist at Baird. Technology companies, retailers, and other stocks that were big winners during the pandemic have been among the biggest losers this year. That includes a more than 35% tumble for Tesla, a 70% nosedive for Netflix, and more than 50% plunge for Facebook parent Meta. Rising bond yields have made these stocks look overpriced relative to less risky corners of the market, such as utilities, household goods makers, and healthcare firms. These are often called value stocks to distinguish them from stocks of high growth companies. Energy is the lone gainer this year among the 11 sectors in the S&P 500. The sector is up 29.9% so far, buoyed by surging oil and gasoline prices. Of the 25 stocks in the index that have risen more than 20% this year, all but eight companies are energy companies. The soaring prices at the pump are the result of a classic squeeze. Demand surged for gasoline and other oil products after the economy roared out of the cavern created by the coronavirus. At the same time, supplies for crude oil and gasoline have remained tight. The invasion of Ukraine upset a key energy-producing region of the world, with sanctions blocking oil from Russia, which ranked third in the world for oil production at the end of last year. Meanwhile, refineries have less ability to turn oil into gasoline in the U.S. after several shut down during the pandemic. U.S. refining capacity has dropped for two straight years, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. As a result, gasoline prices have shot to records this year, with the national average for a gallon of regular topping $5 per gallon earlier this month, according to AAA. That's meant misery for many drivers, but a nice payoff for investors who bet on energy stocks. For such strength to continue, though, worries about a recession would have to abate. Recessions have historically led to drops in oil prices by destroying demand. And over the past week, stocks of energy companies have dropped even more than oil prices, as some investors grew more fearful of just such a scenario, according to strategists at Barclays. Sometimes even the calm one in the group loses their cool. Bonds are supposed to be the steadier, more reliable part of a portfolio, but they're not only slammed investors with losses in the first half of this year, they're on pace for one of their worst performances in history. High-quality investment-grade bonds were down 11.3% for the first 6 months of 2022, as of June 27th. Any down year is a notable thing for bonds. The Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Index, which many bond funds use as their benchmark, has had just four losing years on records going back to 1976. This year's losses are entirely the result of high inflation and the Fed's response to it. Inflation is generally anathema to investors because it erodes the purchasing value of the fixed payments bonds will make in the future. The yield on the 10-year Treasury has already more than doubled this year. It stood at 2.98% June 30th. More pressure may be on the way as the Fed keeps raising rates, though some analysts say the worst may have passed. And then for crypto, supporters of cryptocurrencies have touted them as, among other things, a good hedge against inflation and a safe haven when the stock market slumps. They've been neither of those this year. Bitcoin sank from nearly $69,000 in November to below $20,000 this month, partly due to the same forces that pummeled stocks, inflation, and higher interest rates. Some events unique to the cryptocurrency industry also factored in and eroded investors' confidence. A so-called stablecoin collapsed, costing investors around $40 billion. A hedge fund dedicated to digital assets was reportedly facing liquidation, and some bank-like companies, which take cryptocurrencies as deposits and then lend them out, suspended withdrawals as they scrambled to shore up their finances. I'll now move to the section called The Motley Fool. There's a few short articles there. The first one is Focus on Dividend Growth. It's smart to seek strong dividend-paying stocks for your portfolio, but don't just focus on dividend yields. Yield is important, but so is the dividend's growth rate. A dividend's yield expresses how much of the stock's current price you'll receive annually in dividend form. To calculate it, you divide the annual dividend amount by the current stock price. Thus, when a stock price falls, the yield rises, and vice versa. As an example, if Buzzy's Broccoli Beer pays 25 cents per quarter or $1 per year and is trading at $33 per share, its yield will be $1 divided by 33, which is about 3%. It's great to have dividend payers in your portfolio because they tend to keep paying you regularly, no matter what the overall economy is doing or whether the stock is rising or falling. If a dividend-paying company is really struggling, though, it's possible that it will reduce, suspend, or eliminate its payout. Another great thing about dividends from healthy and growing companies is that they tend to be increased over time. Check this out. Imagine that you bought 100 shares of Buzzy's for $3,300. You'd receive $100 in dividends in the first year. Let's say that Buzzy's increases in dividends by about 7% annually. In 10 years, its dividends will be nearly $2 per share, delivering $200 in annual income. 15 years after that, the dividend will pay you around $543, On your $3,300 purchase, you're now receiving $543 for the year. That's an effective dividend yield of 16% on your original investment. Better still, assuming that Buzzies is still healthy and growing, the shares themselves will have increased in value over those years. If they're at $180 per share, that $5.43 per share dividend will still sport a yield of 3%. But those who bought long ago will be getting a yield that's effectively much higher. So that was a little quick review on dividends. Now the next one is My Dumbest Investment. My dumbest investment? Well, to be honest, it's been self-help books. Success in life and finances all comes down to a few things. Consistency, high quality effort, and good habits. Do these and you are golden. That was submitted by TL. And the Motley Fool responds to this. Many people find self-help books, well, helpful. Many such books offer good, if not great, advice, though others in the genre may be of questionable value. To benefit, though, readers need to recognize good advice when they see it and act on it. That's not always easy to do. Your own advice, recommending consistent, high-quality effort and good habits, is solid. To make it more specific to the financial realm, we might say, live below your means, invest in high-quality companies or low-fee index funds, and hang on for many years through market booms and downturns. Good habits would include being diligent about saving and investing and cultivating patience. It's also smart to have low expectations in the short run and high expectations about the long run, because great wealth can be amassed through stock market investing over decades as long as you don't lose focus, faith, or determination. Reading up on investing can help you build confidence in what you are doing. Perhaps start with John Bogle's book, The Little Book of Common Sense Investing. We'll now move to the sports section, and we'll start with Explorers baseball. Sioux City Explorers win 4th of July contest over Winnipeg. The Sioux City Explorers on Monday closed out the home stand with a lot of fireworks on the scoreboard. The Explorers defeated the Winnipeg Goldeyes 7-2 at Lewis and Clark Park, ending a four-game series with their Canadian counterparts. Sioux City got on the board with a Danry Vasquez RBI double. He traded spots with Danny Amaral, who earned a double earlier in the inning. The Explorers scored twice in each of the next three innings. In the second inning, Shane Podsedek hit a two-run home run that cleared the left field wall. He also scored Zach Cohn, who hit a game-winning three-run home run on Sunday night against the Goldeyes. Podsedek hit his first professional homer with that hit. I got a good first pitch, and next one, Winnipeg starter R.J. Martinez left one out over the plate, and I put a good swing on it, he said. I felt good off the bat. It was a new experience. I got my first hit last weekend, and now I got my first home run. That's a big plus one. Posenick is a true rookie, as he just played college ball out of New Mexico. He hit .269 and knocked in 13 RBIs for the Lobos. And yes, that last name should sound familiar, especially to American League fans. Shane is a younger cousin of former big leaguer Scott Podsednik. Amaral scored the first third inning run as Vasquez drove him in with a sacrifice fly. Zawada made it 5-0 game with an RBI double that scored Trey Martin. In the fourth inning, Vasquez had a two-run double. Amaral and Cohn scored on the play. Vasquez is 3-for-4 with four RBIs. Tom Wendell earned the win as he shut down the Goldeyes in six innings. He faced 22 batters and allowed two hits and walked two. Wendell has walked just two in his last 14-plus innings. Wendell responded well after allowing a season-high 10 hits to Sioux Falls last week, but the Canaries scored just twice. Wendell, who is from Maple Grove, Minnesota, was a 2013 second-round pick by the Dodgers, but was part of the Jimmy Rollins trade in 2014. Wendell has connections to Sioux City, as he has family who still reside here. He feels like he's home here, even though he's about 4 hours away from his Minnesota hometown. That's part of the reason why I wanted to come here, Wendell said. I'm able to drive home and see my family. I have family from Sioux City who grew up here. This is almost like a second home. I've been coming here my whole life. Winnipeg scored both its runs in the ninth inning. Sioux City now faces Sioux Falls and Winnipeg to close out the first half of the American Association season. We'll now move to a story, Nebraska story, about the Husker Athletic Program. Nebraska will have a pair of new conference mates 2 years from now, but USC and UCLA have already been around for some of the Huskers' highest highs and lowest lows. Pick a sport, and it's likely Big Red has crossed paths with one Los Angeles school or the other at some significant moment in the last 55 years. High-stakes football games, certainly. NU has been part of 9 contests featuring ranked teams against the Trojans and the Bruins. In 1972, UCLA ended Nebraska's 32-game unbeaten streak and squashed the prospect of 3 straight national titles. The Huskers thumped the Bruins in a top-3 matchup in Lincoln in 1987 and again in 1994 en route to a championship. USC and Nebraska have met just 5 times, though all carried significant weight. The tie in 1970, an upset favoring NU that led to its first football crown. The time the number 1 Trojans came to Lincoln in 2007 and rolled number 14 Nebraska in the first warning sign of a lost season and looming coaching change. Now, so we're next part is about football. A 21-21 outcome with USC in September 1970 put Nebraska on course for its first championship run that changed the program forever. The number 9 Huskers were 2 touchdown underdogs in the LA Coliseum, but overcame 6 turnovers and missed a 22-yard field goal late to equal the number 3 Trojans with more than 73,000 looking on. NU forced 4 takeaways on its own, and linebacker Jerry Murtaugh was among the defensive stars as the Blackshirts held tough in the final minutes. The outcome preserved USC's 23-game unbeaten streak, but altered the national perception of NU for its effort against a team that had made 3 straight Rose Bowls. It even impressed comedian Bill Cosby enough to pop into the Husker locker room for a surprise visit. "It was a great game," Cosby said. "I'd like to have number 20, Johnny Rogers, and number 31, Joe Arduino, come out and meet us in the alley." One of the more surprising upsets of a Husker team ever played out in September of 1972 at the LA Coliseum. Nebraska had won the last 2 national titles and brought the number one ranking in the land out west. UCLA was coming off a 2-7-1 season under a new coach, but 5 NU turnovers, 3 fumbles, 2 interceptions, and half a dozen dropped passes spelled doom for the unbeaten streak that went back 3 years. A field goal with 22 seconds left made the difference in a 2017 Bruins shocker. "You don't ever plan on losing," Nebraska coach Bob Devaney said, but it finally happened. Any lingering doubts that Nebraska was a bona fide championship contender in 1994 disappeared that September as the number 2 Huskers ran over number 3 UCLA 49-21. Big Red flexed at home in front of an ABC national audience, leading 28-7 at halftime and rolling up 484 rushing yards as the Bruins tried and failed to stop the option attack. 7 different Huskers scored, including receiver Brendan Holbein, who was grazed by a bullet a week earlier. NU had won 14-13 the previous season, but left no doubt this time. It claimed its 3rd national title a few months later. "We got our butts kicked," UCLA quarterback Wayne Cook said. "I don't know what you can get out of this game." Now, next part's about basketball. A 45-year-old John Wooden and the preseason number 4 Bruins, who eventually won the Pac-8 conference title, were no match for Nebraska on a December Friday night in Lincoln in 1955. The Huskers won 71-65 in their biggest win that season under second-year coach Jerry Bush, the grandfather of Fred Hoiberg. NU got 22 points from center and Holmesville native Rex Elkwall, along with what players later acknowledged were plenty of favorable officiating calls. The game was easily the highlight of the season for a Nebraska team that would go 7-16. Little did they know, Wooden would go on to be a 10-time national champion and one of the greatest college coaches of all time. Big Red has lost 4 straight to UCLA since then, most recently in 2016. Now for softball. Nebraska would have celebrated a softball championship in Omaha if not for UCLA and a 6'3" starting pitcher. Bruins walked off the Huskers in the 1985 Women's College World Series at Seymour Smith Field on a bases-loaded RBI single in the 9th inning. NU could not cash in against hurler Debbie Doom, stranding 12 base runners in front of a partisan crowd of 3,180. "Additional change is coming," Nebraska AD said, realigning only part of work ahead. The runner-up finish is Nebraska's best ever, though the NCAA later vacated the appearance because of the use of ineligible players. The schools also met at the 1984 and the 1987 event. UCLA is a true champion, NU coach Wayne Daigle said afterward. They showed it last night and they showed it today. Secondly, they are no better than we are. They just got the run first. And then for volleyball. At the height of their powers, two programs put on a show for the ages with the Final Four berth on the line in December 2004. Two-time defending champion USC ultimately prevailed in a five-set classic, upsetting top-ranked Nebraska in a match that laid the foundation for a Big Red title 2 years later. Freshman hitter Sarah Pavan set a school record in the rally scoring era with 35 kills on a record 90 swings, starting on a court crowded with All-Americans. Said USC coach McKaylee, "The athleticism and the eliteness of the players out there was something special." An NCAA record crowd of 13,870 packed the Devaney Sports Center in September 2009 in a coach-versus-daughter thriller that snapped Nebraska's 90-match home-winning streak. The number 5 Huskers fell in 5 sets to number 8 UCLA and freshman center Lauren Cook, who had 48 assists in the win and was named MVP of the tournament weekend. NU coach John Cook welcomed his daughter in as a transfer the following offseason. "I loved it. It was totally like, bring it on. Let's see what you've got," Lauren Cook said then. "He knows everything I can do. He taught me everything." Big Red also beat UCLA in the national semifinals in 1989 and 2006. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, July 5th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. There are no obituaries in today's paper, so we will be continuing with sports. We'll now be going to high school baseball. The Kingsley Pearson High School baseball team scored 13 runs in the third inning on Saturday, 20-1 at a home win over River Valley. Boston Deschaux was 2-for-3 with 2 RBIs and 2 runs scored. Damon Schmid scored 3 runs and he knocked in 2. He also pitched an inning and struck out the side. Evan Newman pitched 2 innings. He fanned 5. Lawton Bronson 7, Westwood 2. Eagles junior Braden Williams was 3-for-3 with an RBI and a stolen base. Woodbury Central 10, Glidden Ralston 0. Wildcats junior Kyan Schultzen threw a one-hit, 5-inning shutout on Saturday night. Schultzen fanned 9 Glidden Ralston batters. Luke Paulson homered as part of a 2-for-3 night. He had 3 RBIs. Oliver Dennis pitched 3 and a third innings and struck out 4. West Monona 2, Ridgeville 0. The Spartans won their 7th game of the season with the first round game over the Raptors. Spartan senior J.J. Lander pitched the entirety of the game and he struck out 10 batters. He also had a hit. Spartans sophomore Jack Jamison had 2 RBIs. Trayson Price also pitched a good game for Ridgeview. The Raptors junior had 9 strikeouts. Spirit Lake 7, Sheldon 1. The Indians won their 8th game of the season. Indian senior Drew Dietering had 2 hits and a stolen base. Jake Cornwall struck out 15 batters. Southeast Valley 11, East Sac 1. Preston Maurer had a hit and an RBI for the Black Raiders in the loss. West Lions 7, Western Christian 1. Wildcats senior Dawson Ripperda had 3 hits in the win. Wildcats senior Cale Blawett drove in 3 runs in the win. Jeremiah Credit doubled for the Wolfpack and struck out 3 batters in the season-ending loss. And now we have a story about an eating contest, even though it is not a local story. It's kind of interesting. Frankfurter munching phenom Joey Jaws Chestnut put to a protester in a chokehold while gobbling his way to a 15th win Monday at the Nathan's famous 4th of July hot dog eating contest in New York, powering down 63 hot dogs and buns at the annual exhibition of excess. In a decisive chow-down comeback, women's record holder Miki Sudo downed 40 wieners and buns to win the women's title after skipping last year's Frankfest because she was pregnant. A spectator wearing a Darth Vader mask rushed the stage momentarily, disrupting the competition. Chestnut put the protester in a brief chokehold before contest officials hurried over and escorted the intruder away. Another protester in a white stormtrooper mask had also snuck behind the competitors and hoisted a sign saying, "Expose Smithfield's Death Star." Smithfield manufactures Nathan's famous hot dogs. After the altercation, Chestnut went back to the task at hand, devouring more hot dogs. Monday marked the contest return to its traditional location outside Nathan's flagship shop in Brooklyn's Coney Island neighborhood. The event was relocated in 2020 and last year because of the coronavirus pandemic. "It's beautiful to be back here in front of a throng of spectators," Chestnut told ESPN after his feat, which the 38-year-old managed while wearing a surgical boot because of a leg injury. "It hurts, but I was in the zone for a little bit. I was ignoring it," said Chestnut. But the pain eventually slowed his pace in the 10-minute competition. Last year, the Westfield, Indiana resident topped his own record by consuming 76 francs in buns. Sudo of Tampa, Florida, set the women's record at 48.5 wieners and buns in 2020, before taking last year off while expecting. She and Nick Wary, a fellow competitive eater whom she met through the Nathan's contest in 2018, welcomed son Max on July 8, 2021. Our next article has the headline, "First of its kind, Iowa law criminalizes fertility fraud." Mark Hansen was celebrating his 57th birthday with a pint when he got the text he had been waiting for all day. The Iowa House of Representatives finally called for a vote on the Fraud in Assisted Reproduction Act. He scrambled to load the roll call's live stream mid-sip. Hansen was going to watch, working on this legislation, sending dozens upon dozens of emails telling and retelling his story, was one of the first actions he'd felt good about since the man he had called Dad revealed a long-held secret nearly a decade ago. "There's something I've never told you," Rodney Hansen said in the twilight of his life, Alzheimer's and cancer raging war on mind and body. "I am not your biological father." He explained that he could not get Hansen's mother pregnant, a result of a teenage case of the mumps, so she went to the town doctor and got injected with something, but not with his sperm, the man Hansen knew as his father insisted, not his. A paternity test confirmed they were not father and son, and DNA tests, the first 23andMe and then Ancestry, validated the hunch haunting Hansen since he found a photo of his mother's doctor, whose features were eerily close to the ones he saw in his own mirror. The reality of his birth dawned. The doctor had used his own sperm in Hansen's mother's insemination, an act to which she said she never consented. As the nearly unanimous vote, 84 yeas to one nay, lit up his small screen, a weight lifted for Hansen. Passing this act meant an Iowa doctor who uses his own semen on a woman or did so in the past will be guilty of a felony, punishable with up to 5 years in prison and forced to register as a Tier 3 sex offender, a classification reserved for the most severe crimes. With the Fraud in Assisted Reproduction Act now law, Iowa joins the vanguard of states enacting fertility fraud legislation. In just 4 years, 9 states have put statutes targeting reproductive fraud on their books, and another 7 states have introduced bills as a direct result of activism from fertility fraud victims. But Iowa's law is the first ever broad-based statute, advocates say, because it goes beyond simply criminalizing the use of reproductive material other than what was agreed upon, and creates penalties for providing false information to patients about a donor's history, as well as to donors about the use of their materials. The law also does away with a statute of limitations on these crimes. Explicitly states that a request for an anonymous donor cannot be used as a defense and features the highest possible civil award, $200,000, of any state. And, especially important to Hansen, in the case of a doctor using his own material, the offending physician is liable for child support and a post-secondary education subsidy, while also being barred from legally claiming a parent-child relationship. Essentially, Iowa said fraud in the process of creating a human being is not acceptable and there will be consequences, both criminally and civilly, said Kara Rubenstein Dainer, CEO of Right to Know, a nonprofit advocating for those who've had DNA surprises. Iowa's new law is the blueprint for legislation that Right to Know would like to see passed in every state, and its bipartisan support has prompted federal legislators to reach out for a possible national legislation. At the bar, Hansen high-fived his friend, tears welling. When Darian called, neither could really speak, praise and gratitude and we did it catching in their throats. That was a good birthday present, Hansen said. My birthday, you know how ironic that is? My birthday. I was coerced to becoming the first state in the nation to pass a broad fertility fraud act started, as so many bills do, with a call from constituent. A resident of State Senator Annette Sweeney's district, a woman who had her own DNA surprise, told her about fertility fraud and the lack of clear processes and paths for those who have been defrauded to seek justice. Many states' general fraud laws could bend to cover some portions of reproductive fraud, and some victims sought relief under contract or medical malpractice laws. But without specific wording in the code, most lawsuits went nowhere, and most guilty parties went free. I thought, I cannot imagine the devastation for everybody involved with this, Sweeney said. Being happy that there is a life, but people were lied to throughout the whole process, and I don't like people being taken advantage of. Sweeney introduced a version of the bill last year that did not go forward, but she returned to the Capitol in 2022 with a renewed zeal to hone the criminal and civil actions and reach a consensus on both sides of the aisle. I think more people are understanding that, oh my God, that's right, Hansen said, and it's that's not right component that probably pushed it through the Capitol. Although most deceitful insemination incidents happened decades ago, the mass availability of direct-to-consumer genetic testing has only recently brought many of them to light. And with the rising trend came news stories and think pieces that put pressure on state houses to act. Awareness reached a fever pitch this summer with Netflix's smash hit documentary, Our Father, which detailed the crimes of Dr. Donald Klein, a fertility specialist who inseminated dozens of patients with his own sperm, producing at least 95 biological children. Physicians in 22 states have been accused of inseminating patients with their own materials, resulting in hundreds of children, says Tracy Portugal, the child of an accused doctor donor and administrator of Donor Deceived website. Like Klein, some doctors used their own material for years, even decades, before accusations became public. Cecil Jacobson of Virginia fathered as many as 75 children before being prosecuted for perjury and fraud and losing his medical license. In Las Vegas, Quincy Fortier treated patients well into his 90s, siring more than 20 children, many of whom have since met and formed a doctor-donor-conceived support group. And Kim McMaurice, who admitted to using his own sperm on patients in Texas, was allowed to keep practicing despite complaints made to the state's Board of Medicine. He retired last year. In Iowa, Darian is aware of at least 10 other doctor-donor-conceived children who aren't ready to come forward. Even though anonymity and confidentiality were standard in the early era of fertility science, it was never acceptable for a physician to use his own semen or to lie to his patients, said Sean Tipton, spokesman for the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. The society has not taken a stance on these fertility fraud bills, Tipton says, but members are keeping tabs on the movement. Pointing out that there hasn't been an allegation of this crime in the 21st century, Tipton says stricter regulations on human tissues enacted during the Clinton administration seems to have made this activity harder to conceal. Special laws are probably not needed, he said, but Iowa's at least does not do any harm. Passing this law isn't the first time Iowa has been on the vanguard of fertility care. In the early 1950s, two University of Iowa doctors discovered how to freeze and store human semen, kicking off a new era in obstetrics. Soon after, they facilitated the first successful pregnancy using frozen sperm and established the first semen cryobank. Everything started there, so I think it's especially fitting that Iowa has its own fertility fraud law, says Jody Madeira, a Indiana University law professor whose research concentrates on infertility. In addition to guaranteeing important protections for patients, enacting laws like Iowa's helps courts know how to treat these claims that fall through the cracks so easily. These laws say we don't care how long ago this took place. We don't care what happened 20, 30, 40 years ago. We're going to see this as a violation and we're going to protect you, she says. I think they enhance individuals' trust and authority in the law and the law's ability to handle difficult technological subjects. While Madeira was pleased with Iowa's inclusion of child support from doctor donors, she cautions that there are certain issues with this law she'd like to see corrected in other states or in federal legislation. Specifically, Iowa allows donor-conceived children to sue only if their parents are dead or otherwise unable to sue. It's important for the children to sue on their own right because their injury is very different than the parents, she said. It's not a derivative injury, it's an independent injury. Iowa's law also bars civil action if the mother chooses to terminate her pregnancy. It shackles women into keeping the pregnancy that is fraudulent, she said. So if you find out that, God forbid, you're pregnant with a doctor's child and you don't want that child, you cannot abort it. You either abort the child or you abort the cause of the action. You abort the lawsuit. That's an invidious choice. And until the overturning of Roe v. Wade, probably an unconstitutional one, she says. Generally, Madeira hopes future legislation seeks to change the fertility industry's business practices instead of just being responsive to fraud. She'd like to see enhanced and uniform record keeping at clinics, a donor registry, a limit to the number of families that can be created per donor, and a standard to provide children over 18 information on their doctors. We would love to see things that materially change the industry from being about the market and the wishes of intended parents and what's good for business, she says, to what's good for donor-conceived individuals from a human right perspective. A few weeks after his birthday, Hansen made the trek from his house to the Capitol to watch Governor Kim Reynolds sign the new Fraud Act into law. As he drove, his mind wandered, ticking through the big moments of his years-long journey. There was the time he sent a letter to his new siblings, the doctor's children, and when he heard back that they wanted nothing to do with him, and when he joined an online community for others struggling with parentage surprises, finding validation for his emotions, a comfort in their shared misery. How even now he reads through the pain, the heartache, and new members' testimonies as they search, like he once did, for a new definition of family. And working on this law, one he hopes will bring victims a measure of relief. It can't right the wrongs, but at least there are some legs to stand on for victims, he said. Rodney Hansen's comprehensive slid quickly after his admission. He'd never be aware enough again to talk about what happened in that doctor's office in 1964, and 4 months later he died from his illnesses. Since his biological father, the doctor, died in 1983, Hansen can never ask about his motives, but he hopes that it was some sort of science experiment into reproductive medicine, a better, more benevolent option in his mind than being the product of a sexual assault. So much of Hansen's journey since discovering this family secret has been about finding an outlet for all the grief and anxiety and confusion and doubt that took up residence in his heart. The years he spent untangling the mystery of his birth were about repairing his foundation and rebuilding his sense of self, his ethnicity, his traditions, his biological line, his legacy. Those painful things that we go through in life are, looking back, either a lot of fun or very worthwhile, he said. And in this case, I think it was very worthwhile. Heritage, he's learned, can be more than just skin deep. We'll now move to Dear Abby, and our first letter is, Dear Abby, our 26-year-old college-educated grandson, Ethan, crashed his company car and was arrested for DWI and possession of more than a gram of cocaine. His mother hired a lawyer, posted bond, and has taken full charge of the situation. Ethan lost his responsible job, and his girlfriend kicked him out. He has a sizable inheritance, enough to pay the lawyer and fine. Since he has never been in trouble before, we are hoping he will not go to jail. Although we love Ethan dearly, his dad and I agree he should handle this on his own, without his mother, who's recently divorced from our son, running to his rescue. Ethan also needs to help with his addictions. He has enough 521 account funds to turn this serious mistake into an opportunity to return to college and get a master's degree. I don't know how much to get involved, directly with Ethan or his mother. Though my wife and I are on good terms with his mother, it appears she does not want our advice. I welcome your suggestion on what to do. Signed, Upset Granddad in Texas. And Abby responds, You can voice your opinion, but beyond that, you should stay out of it. As well-meaning as you are, you cannot force your former daughter-in-law, who is in full mother mode, or Ethan, to abandon the path they are on. All you can do is point out the dangers they may encounter along the way, and hope that they will listen, however frustrating it may be. Next letter. Dear Abby, my fiancé and I recently moved to a new area because his job was relocated. He was really excited to start this new adventure, and I was happy to come along. We have been together for 10 years, high school sweethearts, and we got engaged just before we moved. I noticed he has been Snapchatting with someone. When I asked him about it, he refused to tell me who, but said I should not be concerned. Eventually, he did tell me. It's a female coworker. I don't know much about her other than that she is recently divorced. I'm happy she's out of a bad situation, but I don't understand why she's Snapchatting my fiancé. I also don't understand why he hid it from me until I made a big deal out of it. There are other details about her, which I'm not sure are 100% true, that could change my point of view about this, but since I don't know her, they are hard for me to believe. Should I be concerned, or is my anxiety taking over? I'll be addressing this with him again, but I'm not going to blow up in his face about it. Signed, Doubting in South Dakota. And Abby responds, I'm glad you're not going to blow up because all it would do is make your fiancé defensive. You do, however, need to have a discussion with him about this coworker. If you feel he hasn't been completely honest about her or her circumstances and he has become secretive, recognize it as a huge red flag and proceed from there. Do not get married before this is resolved. Dear Abby, I have been living with my boyfriend Dan for 15 years. He has always worked and he doesn't hit me. If he's mad, he lets go easy and doesn't dwell on stuff. I can't say the same about me. Here's the issue. On his Facebook profile in the relationship status section, he states that he's single. Other times he has used open relationship or it's complicated. We've been together way too long for him to write something like that. I love him, and I don't want a future of living without this man. I feel like I'm wasting precious years. Life goes by so fast. I'm thinking about leaving him. What does he mean by doing that? Can you advise me? Signed, taken in Georgia. Abby responds, please accept my sympathy. You have spent the last 15 years with someone who is commitment phobic. When people post that they're in an open relationship, it means they are interested in exploring other relationships. If what you want is someone to marry, then you are right, if a little late, in thinking about leaving him. The odds that he will give you what you need are slim. Have an honest conversation with Dan about where you are headed as a couple. If your visions don't match, move on. Dear Abby, my husband and I are friendly with another couple our age. They are kind and generous and would do almost anything for us. They'd like to meet us for an occasional dinner. The problem is the husband feels compelled to put on a show in the restaurant, telling jokes and kidding with the waitstaff and patrons sitting around us. The wife talks almost constantly, and so does her husband, so it's hard to have a conversation with them. They take forever ordering and think nothing of holding up the table for hours. We went out last night, and I hinted that I was uncomfortable with the unnecessary attention and would like us to be more low-key. The response was, we like to have fun. It makes us happy, and people always thank us because we make their day. I think people just play along and secretly find them annoying. I don't want to hurt their feelings, but I don't know what to say if they ask us out again. My husband feels the same way as I do. Any suggestions? Signed, Uncomfortable in Arizona. And Abby responds, they may be nice people, but their compulsion to perform in public makes you uncomfortable. Added to that is your inability to talk with them on a meaningful level because they dominate the conversation. If you like them in private, under controlled conditions, invite them over, but politely decline their invitations to eat out. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, July 5th. I'm your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. And thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.